We're talking with Mark Linus, an author, journalist, and green activist, perhaps better known in Europe than here in North America. His previous big book was High Tide, News from a Warming World, a description of 3 years traveling the Earth in search of climate change. Mark, I'd like to talk to you about your new book coming out this March called 6 Degrees. But first, I understand you have another new baby slipped out this month, a Collins Gem book called Carbon Counter. How do people use that one?
Well, I thought you meant a real baby. I actually do have another real baby due. I've got one child already and another one due on the 5th of February. So books, babies, and all coming. Now, yes, this little book called Carbon Counter, which was published just in the beginning of January by Collins here in the UK, is essentially just a very small pocket-sized thing to help you calculate your carbon footprint. So it just has all of the bits and pieces of calculations you need just to put, you know, if you get your electricity bill, your gas bill, and your car mileage and a couple of other things together, you can come out with a pretty good estimate for your own personal contribution to the global warming issue. And, of course, there's plenty of information there in the book as well about how to reduce your carbon footprint. It's pretty much UK-specific, and so it wouldn't be much use for a Canadian audience. There may be similar publications already available where you are, I think.
That sounds handy, all right. Well, that does lead to the larger picture, namely what happens to the planet as the climate heats up, triggered by our inordinate use of fossil fuels. Why the title 6 Degrees for your new book?
Well, 6 Degrees is what the scientific projections are, the upper-level scientific projection is for the year 2100. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in its last big report in 2001, and there's another one due out now at the beginning of February, so that this may or may not change, but the projections were for temperature rises due to global warming of between 1.4 and 5.8 degrees by the end of this century, so between 1 and 6 degrees, essentially. And what I've done in this book is to bring together all of the scientific projections, so computer model studies, plus look back at the past using paleoclimate data to give a sense of what will happen, what the impacts will be on the planet at each degree level of change. So chapter one is what the planet looks like at 1 degree warmer. Chapter two is what it looks like at 2 degrees warmer, and so on up the scale. It's that simple, but it's very much for a general audience, just so that people can really read about what the latest information that the scientists have been putting out.
I've been to your blog at www.marklinus.org, and you give a brief outline of the changes for the first 3 degrees. I was alarmed at just 1 degree of climate change, a new dust bowl for the United States and much colder weather for Britain and Europe due to changes in the Gulf Stream. How fast is our temperature rising?
At the moment, it's rising faster on a sort of year-by-year and decade-by-decade basis than has been the case for hundreds and probably thousands of years. It's rising at about 0.3 degrees per decade. So if the temperatures continue at rising at about this rate, then we'd be into the 2-3 degree mark already by the year 2100. And in fact, we're likely to see a temperature acceleration because we haven't even begun to see the amount of warming which is already inherent in the system. You've got to think about this, the actual thermal time lag that the planet operates on. It's a bit like, you know, when you start boiling a kettle, it takes quite a long time to really get going. And it's the same with the planet Earth. We've loaded the atmosphere with more greenhouse gases than has been the case for millions of years already. And the temperatures are now just beginning to catch up, but they've got quite a long way to go yet. So even if we, one of the unfortunate conclusions of the book is even if we scale, completely cut back on greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we'd still probably get a degree or more of global warming because that's now unavoidable. What we have to do is make sure that we try and avoid going anywhere over 2 degrees, because if we do cross that threshold, then we will also cross some of the tipping points, which may well make runaway climate change a reality, in which case we would have lost the entire battle, because there's no going back.
And I suppose the ocean is a bit of a delay effect, too. As it heats up, it takes a while to heat it up, but then once it's there, we get the full heat from it.
Yes, that's right. There's immense thermal mass locked up in the oceans. So it takes, you know, it can take 1,000 years for water which sinks in the Greenland Sea to eventually surface again somewhere in the Pacific. And all of that time that the water's been at the bottom of the ocean, it's not in contact with the atmosphere, so it isn't heating at all. So it takes that long for the oceans to equilibrate with the atmosphere, if you like. So the oceans will carry on warming for 1,000 years or more, even after greenhouse gas emissions cease.
Regarding the Gulf Stream, last spring you told a group in Scotland that cool weather was likely a sign of the Gulf Stream weakening, but this year winter hardly came to Europe, well, so far. Won't critics say this is a contradiction?
Well, they might, and they'd be right. It is a contradiction. I think the jury's very much out on the Gulf Stream thing. I mean, the Gulf Stream is a non-scientific term. The actual Gulf Stream is a single small current which comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. This is more properly termed the Atlantic Ocean Conveyor or something similar. And this is the whole system of currents which take water north into the Atlantic, and then it sinks to depth at the high part of the Atlantic, say around near Greenland and Iceland. And the reason it sinks there is because of the formation of sea ice, so you get the fresh water squeezed out of it into ice, and then the cold, very cold, salty water, which is heavier than fresh water, sinks down to the bottom. So it's a bit complex to explain. I think people understand pretty much the basics of it now anyway, after The Day After Tomorrow and that Hollywood movie and stuff. And the worry is that as the seas get warmer and fresher in the higher part of the Atlantic, then this conveyor system could begin to shut down. And that would mean that much less oceanic heat is transported into northwest Europe. Some of the studies have already shown that the ocean currents are slowing down, perhaps by as much as 30%, which would be shocking and alarming, except that there hasn't been any cooling of the sea temperatures, so it's not got any cooling yet in northwest Europe, and no one quite knows why. So somewhere along the lines, the data isn't quite accurate. So that's why I say the jury's out.
All right. And at 2 degrees change, you say the Earth could lose up to a third of its species in the worst mass extinction since the end of the dinosaurs. Most of the talk in governments and even by concerned citizens is just about how we humans will adapt. Have we lost sight of the rest of the Earth's citizens, all those other species?
I think we have, really, and it's something which worries me very profoundly, because most of the discussion you hear is either on the basis of economics. I mean, there was a very well-reported study came out recently by Sir Nicholas Stern, who did the work on behalf of the British government, so it's been known as the Stern Report, and this was trying to quantify the financial damage that climate change would do, and it was very well-received by environmentalists, because it said, look, you know, we could lose 10% of the world's economy, and it would only cost 1% of the world's economy to deal with the problem, so let's deal with it. But I have a sort of philosophical problem with trying to put a financial value on the disappearance of the polar bear, for example. I think individual species have an inherent value which is over and above any financial value they might have to humans. But, you know, that's my philosophy as an ecologist, if you like. But I do think that the issue of biodiversity is one which isn't really understood, or people don't really appreciate the value of having such a diverse ecosystems, and how important they are actually for the support of humanity. I mean, we couldn't exist on a lifeless planet either.
Absolutely true. Well, getting to 3 degrees, we lose the Amazon rainforest. We've already seen shocking pictures of rivers there drying up, and they're a huge reservoir of carbon. Once they dry up and other positive feedbacks kick in, is it possible we could skip up the scale and see a rapid increase, perhaps skipping from 3 to 5 degrees without visiting anywhere in between? Could that happen?
Well, that's more or less the concern. I mean, if you cross the 3 degrees threshold, then it becomes much more likely that the Amazon rainforest will burn up essentially and turn into desert, which releases a lot of carbon. And the scientific projections for this happening, and not just in Amazonia, but in the global carbon cycle as a whole, are that it would give us another 1.5 degrees. So if you get to 3, you get, by definition, almost to 4.5 degrees, if these projections are correct. So that's a very crucial tipping point, because then you think down the line, when you're at 4.5 degrees, you're going to be seeing major releases of Siberian methane from permafrost and so on, which is then going to take you further up the scale. So it's a bit like a deadly game of dominoes that you knock one over and the whole lot's going to go somewhere down the line.
Have you seen the map that James Lovelock presented at his talk in November to the Institution of Chemical Engineers?
I've read his most recent book, and I've spoken to him a couple of times. And It's almost refreshing to hear how gloomy his perspective is, because he doesn't make any effort to try and hide the truth from us, if you see what I mean. So when his instinct, I think, because I don't think it's something which is published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, his instinct is that most of the global systems are already in positive feedback. We just haven't seen the full effects of it yet. And he may be right, and if that's true, then we have already, to a large extent, lost the battle. But I'm not fully convinced about that. And in any case, I think we ought to behave as though the battle were not totally lost, because even if we are committed to a much higher level of warming than I think, we still need to cut our emissions so that we can, at the very least, slow the rate of warming down. The big problem in terms of species going extinct is that the warming is going to be so rapid. Climate has fluctuated before. I mean, if you think about the ice age cycles, the climate was 5 degrees colder at the depth of the last ice age than it is now. So these temperature changes have happened, and species have managed to adapt to them. But in the case of the ice ages and other changes, they happened over thousands of years. So what we're talking about is changes of that magnitude or more happening within the space of a single century. And that's why it's identified with mass extinction. So even if the changes even if the warming is going to happen somewhere down the line, the slower we can make it, the better.
Well, Mark Lynas, I've heard a lot of interviews where people quote the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but they do represent governments, which tend to be very conservative, and usually I hear scientists say these estimates are far too low, but they say it at the end of the interview almost in a whisper, speaking unofficially. Are we getting a realistic picture about climate change?
Well, the IPCC is unusual body. I mean, it is a scientific organization. It comprises of scientists, and its reports are written by scientists. But I mean, it's important to understand that the IPCC isn't doing its own studies. It's simply summarizing the state of the science as it is seen at each of these 6-yearly intervals. But what goes through the machinery of governments is the summary for policymakers particularly, and that has to be agreed line by line by government representatives. So that's where the situation gets rather more blurred. But I think the actual meat of the IPCC reports are very useful, although that by the time they come out, they do tend to be slightly out of date. And there's things every single time there's a new study reported, it tends to be worse than the last one. So in the IPCC report, it might talk about the disappearance of the Arctic ice cap, in the Arctic Ocean by 2070, 2080 on business as usual emission scenarios. And the latest projections say that could happen by 2040. So, because most of the stuff in the IPCC is 2 or 3 years old, it won't have that latest information in it.
You've raised the point that we shouldn't give up, and we'd need a whole other interview to talk about your solutions. But can you give us a quick rundown of a few ideas that will work and maybe a couple that won't?
Well, ideas that won't work, top of my list, are these geoengineering schemes you sometimes hear about, such as putting iron filings in the ocean or space-based solar mirrors, or the latest one I've heard of is where they want to spray sulfur dioxide high up into the atmosphere from aeroplanes to try and increase global dimming, more or less mimicking acid rain pollution, and to try and give us bias some time that way. I'm concerned about them both in their direct effects, which I think will be unknown until it's done, and also by their psychological effects, which give people the idea that there's some technological solution out of this, which doesn't involve reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We know the problem. We've got the smoking gun. It's simply a case of catching the criminal now, and that means getting our emissions down. And there's many ways to do this, which do involve technology, such as generating renewable power and so on. But most important is actually to reduce our energy consumption. Energy use goes up in industrialized societies and in the developing world year on year simply because people consume more and more stuff. And, there's huge amounts of energy wastage. Even if you look at the average home, there's a lot of waste because people don't properly insulate their houses and things like that, which are very easy to deal with pretty moderate financial outgoings. And also, if you look at the way that people live their lives with consumer society where all of the shopping's done in big supermarkets and it's all very car-based, These patterns of lifestyles have to change too. And I actually think the thing to realize here is that we would probably living in a much more fulfilling lifestyle if we weren't burning so much carbon. If you, just to give you one example, if you shopped locally rather than at Walmart or whatever it's called, then you're more likely to be seeing more people in your community. You know, it's more likely people are going to talk to each other. Actually, the quality of life for not having a supermarket-based lifestyle is much higher. So it's not as if reducing greenhouse gas emissions is necessarily a huge sacrifice. In many ways, I think we'd have a more positive society resulting down the line because of it.
Well, speaking of localization, how soon do you see the carbon costs of globalization, you know, shipping everything from Asia or whatever, becoming a real issue for business and the public?
Well, that depends on where carbon is beginning to be regulated. I mean, in the European Union, there is already the emissions trading scheme where the biggest emitters have to reduce their emissions or buy unused permits from elsewhere. It hasn't really worked in the first few years because governments have given in to business lobbying and have granted too many permits. So, in fact, there was almost more permits than any of them needed. So that basically busted the budget. It's rather like inflation. If you print money, then money is worth nothing. The same happened with carbon emissions. But what the world is waiting for at the moment is for Kyoto to work. So for the countries which are participating in Kyoto to actually begin to try and do something about it, and B, for President Bush to get thrown out of office, and for America to rejoin the international effort to get carbon emissions down, because then companies, particularly US-based multinationals, will have some sense of where the world is going. They already know that at some stage down the line, they're going to see carbon emissions regulated, and they know that, you know, if you're a big energy company, you've got an investment horizon of 30, 40 years. If you're going to build a power plant, it's going to have a lifetime of that long. So you don't want to put up a coal-fired power station if you think that in 10 or 15 years that's going to be regulated and you're not going to make any profit on it. So business in many ways is actually one of the voices now demanding regulation and demanding to know where things are going to go rather than standing in the way of action on greenhouse gases, which was always the case in the past. So in some ways, environmentalists and business are increasingly on the same side, which is an odd situation to find themselves in.
And what about the issue of peak oil? You know, the people who believe that our production high point has already been reached and so oil burning will decrease simply because the energy supplies are running out. Do you see that happening, or do you see it happening in time to save us from severe climate change?
Well, I wish oil had run out 50 years ago, to be honest. if peak oil was a reality, which I'm not sure that it is, then I'd say bring it on. The problem is that the world may be running out of cheap oil, but it's not running out of hydrocarbons. And you can see this in Alberta in Canada, where they're mining these oil sands at huge energy cost and huge environmental toxic legacy that's going to leave. In fact, you get far more fossil fuel emissions per barrel of oil extracted from these oil sands than you do from a barrel of oil extracted from the Middle East. So in some ways, if we're running out of cheap oil, then the alternatives are going to be worse because they're going to be involving low-grade oil shales and oil sands and a return to coal. So that's actually going to make the future more carbon-intensive if the world goes in that direction. But on the other side, the end of cheap oil does make energy more expensive and makes renewables more attractive and competitive as a result. So higher energy prices are pretty much a good thing. I'm not a pessimist on the peak oil scenario, and I'm a bit of a skeptic. And there's a lot of peak oil doomsaying going on, and I think what people have to understand is that this all comes down to economics. You're talking about energy prices and things that most of the people who preach the peak oil mantra don't know anything about. You know, it's not like everyone who talks about peak oil has a degree in economics and can see really how markets respond. It's not simply a case of the physical realities of the amount of oil which is out there and how it's going to make its way into your particular, you know, car gas tank.
We presume Sir David King does know what he's talking about in the economy. He wrote the report for the UK government. And in an article in the New Statesman, you said that his goal of 550 parts per million of CO2 in the greenhouse gases would be nothing less than a death sentence for half the world's population. That sounds so extreme. How did you arrive at such a gloomy calculation?
Simply because if I look at the work I've been doing for the Six Degrees book, 550 ppm equates to between 3 and 4 degrees of warming, which if I then follow that through and look at the impacts that implies, we'd see the well, not only will we see the loss of the Amazon and the crossing of those tipping point thresholds, but we'd see the disappearance of glaciers in South America and making large areas of the western coast uninhabitable for millions of people there. The disappearance of glaciers in the Himalayas, which would shift people out of Pakistan. The rising of sea levels, which would displace tens of millions of people around the world, and not to mention extreme weather events. So, and also large areas of increasingly uninhabitable new desert zones as the subtropical belts expand outwards towards the poles. So there'd be increasing areas of the globe's surface which would be uninhabitable to humans at the 3 and 4 degree rise in temperature levels. And so people will be crowding into areas which still can grow crops and still are cool enough to be habitable. And there would be far too many people to be supported by the amount of food production which still goes on. So this is a recipe for famine, and it's a recipe for large-scale starvation and conflict. And that's why I think that allowing CO2 levels to rise that high would be a death sentence for half of humanity. I think it's a statement about the future which you can never be absolutely certain about, but I think it's certainly more probable than wishing that this will somehow all be okay.
Will you be coming to North America to promote your book?
I find myself in a quandary when it comes to things like book promotion, and because I'm trying to keep my travel, particularly aircraft travel, down to an absolute minimum of zero, if possible. I certainly don't travel on aeroplanes for holidays or anything like that personally. But sometimes it seems that, you know, the preaching of the climate change message makes it worthwhile to actually travel to some places. But at the moment, I'm not sure about this. I'll if I do come, I'll try and get as much done per trip as I possibly can.
How do people find your book and your website?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, my website's on marklynas.org, and that's spelled marklynas.org. And the book's called 6 Degrees, and it will be published in North America, or I'm not exactly sure by whom and when. But if people are interested, then do check out the website, and I'll put details up as they come.
All right. From his home in England, we've been speaking with Mark Lynas, author and activist, about his new book, 6 Degrees. Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with Radio EcoShock today.
It's my pleasure.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.